Hey there! Welcome to the Journey Into podcast. Here to do another Strewn Along the Path episode. This one's not going to be a Netflix queue episode. I'm not going to be talking about a superhero television show or anything like that. I've invited Rish Outfield to join me here from the Delusions of Grandeur podcast. And we're going to try something a little bit different. And we're gonna talk about an old movie. How's it going, Rish?
It's going fine. Where did the idea for us doing this come from?
Well, I've been thinking about something to do extra on the podcast. I've been playing with the idea of starting a Patreon. And some of the Patreons that I listen to, some of their things that they offer their Patreons is extra episodes that they do either on a monthly basis or, you know, some frequent basis that they offer. So, yeah, so I've been thinking about that. And then I think you had suggested something like, hey, we should sit down and talk about a movie or something like that after listening to one of my Strewn Along the Path episodes, one of the Netflix queues. And so I said, you know what, we should try this. We should try to do a movie. And I challenged you to a duel to talk about the movie Duel, because I think we've talked about it years ago, and I always kind of wanted to talk with you about it more, and I figured why not just do that for the podcast. So
okay,
that's my recollection. I don't know if you remember anything different.
But is this an experiment to see if this is something we should do again, or is this just a one-off?
This is like a pilot episode of a podcast, a potential podcast. And I guess if we enjoy it and think of other movies that we'd like to talk about together, and if we get some response from the audience and this is something that they'd like to do, you know, maybe I could add it as a start a Patreon and add it as an added bonus to the Journey Into podcast. Or, if I'm lazy, I'll just do it anyway. I don't know if that's lazy or...
Well, I don't have an answer for you there, man.
I mean, is it...
It's
probably... The lazy thing would probably be not to do any extra podcast at all.
Yes,
if we enjoy this and want to do it, I don't know if, you know, I don't know.
The lazy choice is just to pod fade completely.
It is. It is.
I found that idea attractive. I enjoy listening to when you're driving down the road and you talk about movies that you saw on Netflix recently. But I have found myself saying, oh, whoa, no. As if we're in a car together. I try to interrupt you. I try to correct you. Where he's like, no. Michael Ironsides was not the guy. It was it was Ronnie Cox, and you don't pause. In fact, you don't even acknowledge that I'm talking. And so
it's just... Michael B. Jordan in what was it? Oh, Independence Day Resurgence. I kept saying that, and you're probably going out of your mind on that one.
But it wasn't Michael B. Jordan, was it?
It was not Michael B. Jordan. No, I was wrong. So yeah, I have noticed I've had to add a fact checker text to my posts on the blog site.
So. Well, I in 1998, my best friend and I started a website where we reviewed horror movies. And
okay,
shortly after that, I got out of school and I moved to California. And it was a way that he and I managed to stay in touch, is we would get together and we would talk about horror movies. We'd just call each other up or whatever, and we both go to the same movie on the same night and then talk about it out in the, when we got home. And, it was really enjoyable. It got to be where it's like, I didn't feel like I had actually seen the movie until I had talked to him about it. I didn't know whether I liked it or not until I told him whether I liked it or not. And I wish that we had done that as a podcast. I think it just would have been
right
more satisfying, more fun. And anyhow, yeah, having two people talk about movies, it's tried and true. I think hopefully this will be entertaining to somebody.
Yeah, I think so. You know, it probably depends on the movies we choose or whatever. But
well, yeah. And why did you choose Duel, if I may ask?
Well, I chose, one of the main reasons is because it's Steven Spielberg's first movie. It's a TV movie that he did, I think it was back in 72. And I had never heard about it or seen it before. Somehow I caught wind of it and I looked it up and I rented it on Netflix. You know, I don't know, this is probably 10 years ago or whatever. And the DVD that I got also had like a little documentary about it. And they showed the young Steven Spielberg talking about it. And this was, would that be 6 years before Jaws? Or no, 4 years before Jaws, right?
Right.
Yeah, so. Yeah,
it was 1971, and he was 24 years old.
Okay, yeah.
And, yeah, he had done a little bit of television. He did the pilot episode of Night Gallery in 1968, and he had done an episode.
Columbo, gosh, what was the show? Right?
Well, he had done Columbo, but there was a two-hour series called The Name of the Game. Hmm. And he did an episode called Los Angeles 2017 back in 1971.
Wow.
And it was an episode of a TV series. And then based on that, his agent got him to read the Richard Matheson story that this is based on.
Okay,
Because ABC was going to make it into a TV movie, and they were looking for someone to direct it. And I think they recognized that it was going to be hard to pull this off on a television budget. And more importantly, on the super small schedule that they had. And Spielberg, in that same documentary you were talking about, remembers how hungry he was back then.
Right.
And that he would go without food and he would go without sleep. And, you know, he would do whatever it took to be the guy that got the job. And he was just so passionate about it that he told him, yeah, I can do this in 10 days. Well, I guess we can talk more about it afterward.
After we talk about the plot, yeah.
But ultimately, he failed as far as that goes, the 10 days thing. But he didn't fail as far as the movie goes.
Right.
Duel is one of those movies that anytime it's on TV, when I'm clicking through the channels, I will watch it. You know, I remember coming home for the holidays 10, 15 years ago, and I was on my parents' couch, and it was like 2 a.m., and I was about to go to sleep, and Duel was on, like TBS, the superstation. And I was like, oh, shoot. And yeah, I just stayed up until 4 or whenever it was, and I sat through the commercials because I don't know. That movie is special in that way to me.
Yeah, I really liked it too. And and I think I remember after reading that documentary, I was kind of fascinated. And I think I asked you about it at one point. And you said, you gave me that same sentiment that you can't not watch it if it's on. And that you were pretty impressed with it as well. And so since then, I've always had the idea, oh, I need to talk more with Rish about Duel. So I figured this was the opportunity to do it.
Okay, so do you feel like summing up the plot of the movie, or do you feel like going through the whole movie, or what? How would you like to do this?
I think maybe we could, talk about just the basic premise of it and kind of introduce the actors, well, the actor mainly, and then just kind of go through some of the moments that we liked and that kind of thing. I don't think we need to give a full play-by-play of it.
Okay, yeah, but some people do. Some people say, okay, so the movie starts with, and they go all the way until the end of the movie, and people don't even have to watch the movie. They can just feel like, okay, I know what it's all about. Everybody's got their own style. This is one of the most basic stories. I mean, it's really, you could sum the whole movie up in a long sentence.
Yeah, essentially you could.
Go ahead and try.
Okay. So this is a movie. Well, we'll get into the actor later. But it pretty much follows the Travels of a Man out of L.A., I believe. And it looks like he's going towards Bakersfield and on some kind of a business trip. And along the way, he gets behind this really old tanker truck that, you know, blowing smelly exhaust and everything. And so he passes it, and eventually the truck passes him and then starts to kind of to play with him, like he didn't appreciate being passed or whatever. And it just escalates through the entire movie, how this cat and mouse, this game that and the kind of the terrorizing of this guy by this tanker truck. And it just continues to go on as he travels down the road, and like I said, it escalates and escalates until the very end. Is that too wordy? I didn't use it in one sentence for sure, but
no, it wasn't one sentence, but I was sort of exaggerating. But yeah, the basic is probably not the word that I'm meaning.
It's lean.
It's just got a really simple premise, and there's not a lot to it, but it really works. And I wonder, I wonder, do you need more in that? Or could we, in appreciate a movie like that in 2018? I guess those are rhetorical questions. It's just a super simple premise, and it's not got like a ton of subtext or twists or any of that stuff. In that documentary, Spielberg talks about the foreign press writing up that Duel is about this, and the character's name is David Mann, and so clearly that means this. And he's like, I didn't intend any of that stuff. It's just, no, it's the movie is what it is.
Right.
It's like he makes an enemy out of the wrong guy, or ticks off some guy, and we don't know why the truck driver goes after him, really. There's no excuse for what he does. And maybe part of that is why it's scary. We never see the truck driver.
Right.
We don't ever see his face. We see his arm, we see his feet. And so that makes him almost inhuman. It's almost as though the truck and the man are one being. Like a David Mann has angered the truck rather than a truck driver.
Yeah, if this was Stephen King, you know, like a Christine type of thing, we might think that the truck is possessed or something like that. But no, it's just there is a driver. And like you said, I think that was one of the coolest things. And I guess that probably comes from the screenplay. But I really liked how we don't ever see or humanize the antagonist. He's just this mystery guy. The truck takes on the persona of that. Yeah, so I looked it up here on good and trusty IMDb, and okay. this is their one sentence synopsis of it. They say, a business commuter is pursued and terrorized by the malevolent driver of a massive tractor trailer, which I guess is pretty much what I said. More succinct. But there is one major twist that, I mean, having seen it before, it wasn't a twist the second time around, of course. But there's this sequence where he's in front of the truck and they're coming down a hill. And this is fairly early on. And the truck's just coming right up on him and bumping him a couple times. And just, he has to go faster and faster. And, you know, he's coming onto this little town, this little stop in the road, and eventually, he's able to go off the road and stop, but he skids out and hits a fence and just all shook up and you know, sweaty. The truck keeps going, and he's just trying to calm himself down. And he goes into this diner and goes into the bathroom, and it's all kind of tracking, you know, this one shot kind of camera thing. And one of the things that I thought was kind of, I thought it was kind of weird at first, but you kind of have to do it to understand what he's thinking. You can start to hear his thoughts and what he's thinking. And, why would this guy be doing this kind of thing? And then, so he kind of calms himself down, washes his face and comes out and pretty much, thinks this is over. And then he sees the truck parked outside the diner out in the window. And I don't know if the music changes, but that's kind of one of those moments that you're like, oh crap, this is going to continue. And then of course he's trying to figure out who the driver is of the truck. And I thought that was a pretty cool moment.
Yeah, I think that's my favorite part of the movie, is that scene in the diner. And I remembered him having an inner monologue through the whole movie. And so when I saw it this time, I was waiting for that. And there's a few times when he talks to himself while he's driving. But I was just like, oh, I thought that went through the whole thing, like a narration.
Right.
But it kicks in then, right?
Yeah.
And then we get a little bit more throughout the film. But that scene is so different than all the rest. And that part where he goes up to, he's like, okay, that looks like the kind of guy that would drive a truck like this. And he goes up to a stranger and says, hey, look, no hard feelings, but you can't do that. And we don't know, is that the guy that he's talking, is he talking to the right guy? Is that a stranger? Does that guy know what he's talking about? And everybody gives him a suspicious look. Everybody is a suspect,
right,
in the diner. And he talks to a bunch of guys, and some guy, decides to lay him out, beat him up. And then at some point, man thinks, why didn't I just get in my car and drive away the second I knew the driver was in here? And it's one of those things. It's like, yes, now that it's too late, you have this great idea of what you should have done.
Yeah, yeah.
I just really, really like that scene. And yeah, it is all one big tracking shot when he first walks in, and set up perfectly where there is the truck as the reveal at the end of that shot.
Why didn't I leave right away when I saw his truck outside? Then I'd know what he intends to do. What if he followed me out, though? Started after me again? I'd be right back where I started. Even if I got a lead, he'd overtake me soon enough. He's got some souped up diesel. My car's just not that powerful. I just can't drive 80 and 90 miles an hour. As soon as I stop concentrating, I'd go back to 60 or 70 like I always do. It's a habit. I can't help it. He's just like, take it easy. Just take it easy.
Yeah, that was just done really well, because he's just this every man kind of character. And, he's kind of a meek guy, you can tell. And, you just wonder, what would you do in that situation? How would you get out of that? Yeah, as he's looking around and people are kind of glancing at him because he's acting kind of strange. But he's trying to figure out who it is. He's looking at their boots, but they all pretty much have cowboy boots on. Because he did see them, because they both went to a gas station earlier. So he did see the guy get out of his truck and kick his tires or whatever, so he saw the boots underneath the truck. But yeah, it felt like I was watching a Alfred Hitchcock movie or something at that point. It's just kind of, you're in his headspace and you're trying to figure it out. And then one of the guys is the truck driver. He's going out and he goes behind the truck like he's going to get in and take off, but then he comes out with another truck that was just behind the bigger one. And I don't know, that was pretty cool how all that worked out.
Yeah, I think Hitchcock would have appreciated this movie. I'm assuming he saw it, because in 1971, everybody would have said, Hitch, oh, you got to watch this.
Yeah.
And clearly this guy, this kid that made this movie, is a fan of yours and your style. And one of the missives that Spielberg had in this movie and in Jaws was that, what you don't see, it's scarier than what you do see.
Yeah.
Your imagination fills in the gaps. And apparently Matheson's script says you never see the face of the driver. But Yeah, it just, I don't know. It dehumanizes him. And also you never hearing his voice, never hearing a motivation as to why I did this. Because, okay, yeah, he passes him, and I think he honks at him at one point. But I nobody would rationally say that's an excuse to murder somebody. So Spielberg also said that it has all these license plates on it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Those are trophies of places he's been, people he's run down over the years, kind of thing. Like, you know, having a notch on your rifle butt. And
yeah, like he's looking for the next guy.
Yeah, it's just that's... that, I don't know if that's something they came up with later, but it's... you buy it. Yeah, and it's such an ugly truck, dude. Just that gross rust color. Yeah, you would have to get a tetanus shot just, you know, bumping into that truck.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you can tell, you know, it hasn't been, like, the oil or whatever kind of material is in there. You know, you can see there's drips and stuff coming off the top or down on the front of the tanker trailer. So, did you know much? I don't remember. Dennis Weaver is the main actor. He has... You know, pretty much the whole movie to himself, except for some of these other side characters that come through. But I guess he was a pretty big deal. He was on a TV show for several years called MacLeod. But I don't remember seeing that when I was a kid. Of course, I was only... two when this movie came out.
So. He was in MacLeod before Duel or after Duel?
I think it during, like, I think it was from 70 to 76 or 77 is when MacLeod was.
Okay.
But I don't remember seeing him in much. I guess he was in an old Twilight Zone episode.
Which Twilight Zone is that?
It's the one, I can't remember the name of it, but it's the one where the guy is going to be executed and he keeps reliving that over and over again.
Wait, he's in the courtroom?
And yeah, Shadow Play is the name of it.
And he wants the governor to call and the governor never calls. He's never able to convince them that is he trying to convince them that he didn't do it or that this is a dream?
That this is a dream, that they're all imaginary.
And every time he has the dream...
they're all going to disappear.
Right, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's weird. I remember that one.
Okay.
and it's just every time he has the dream, it's all the same characters, all the same people in the dream, but they're playing somebody else.
Oh, okay.
So, like,
yeah,
the next time he wakes up, the guy who was the judge in the last... episode is, you know, is his cellmate this time through, and the guy that was his lawyer is now, you know, the opposing counsel or the, you know, the governor that's supposed to call, and now this time the judge is a woman, and he tries to explain to them, you know, this I know what you're gonna say, that this is not, none of you are real, you all exist in my head.
Not again. I won't die again. You can't make me die again! Oh, God, please, please, please! Tell him, Mr. District Attorney, that this isn't real! Make him understand they're only a dream I'm having! You fools, you kill me, you'll die! You believe me! Make him believe me! Tell the District Attorney he's prosecuted himself and everybody in this building and everybody in the world! Tell him, Mr. Carson, before it's too late.
Okay, why am I over-explaining? But I could talk about Twilight Zone every single week, too. Spielberg said that he cast Dennis Weaver because Weaver had this little part in Touch of Evil where he was this crazy man who was super manic and, like, jumping around and laughing like that and that. And he's like, I want the character of David Mann to be that guy at the end of this story. We start out with, like, a very composed, serious, almost humorless character. And then after this experience, he's jumping up and down and manic and laughing and he's gone off the deep end. And yeah, they said, well, hey, let's see if Weaver would play that part. And he was happy to take the role.
Yeah, I thought it, the second time I watched it, I noticed a lot of things that they were building into his character. You know, I mean, the whole thing takes place in his car. You know, we see him driving through town, and through the opening credits, it's just him driving down the road, and we hear the radio playing and see what's going on with the radio, or hear everything anyway. And as I was paying attention to that, you know, there's kind of this little thing going on about this guy that is having problems with his wife or whatever, and that who's the boss kind of thing. And then when he goes to a gas station, he calls his wife, and they had an argument the night before, and he had kind of failed to defend her honor or whatever. And she was kind of putting him down for being too meek, you know, too not standing up for things. And so I didn't realize, you know, pay attention to that as much the first time I watched it. But it's kind of a neat way to build his character, I think, to have those themes kind of throughout there. But I don't know if you'd notice it if you hadn't already seen the movie once before, but
I wasn't paying attention to that. I was so surprised by how long that opening is with him like pulling out of his driveway and going down the road. And we would just watch the commute and listen to the radio for so long. And I think you are aware of this, but and anybody who's ever watched the DVD version, the video version, may be aware of this, but the film was actually released theatrically internationally, but it was too short.
Right. Yeah. Yep.
It needed to be at least 90 minutes long. And so Universal gave Spielberg 2 extra days afterward to shoot scenes. So the length of the movie could get up to feature length. And one of those scenes was that, of just the super long credit sequence, I guess. Another scene is the school bus scene with the kids.
Oh, okay.
And then the third scene is when he pulls up to the railroad tracks, and then the truck comes along and tries to push him onto the tracks when the train is coming. Those were all added scenes for the theatrical release.
Okay, yeah, I had forgotten about that.
They redubbed a few lines here and there, so that it wouldn't seem like a television movie, I guess, where, you know, a little bit more cussing, I guess, than had been in the original version. But it made me curious what the 70-minute version would be like compared to the 90-minute version. And
that school bus scene was pretty interesting, because it's kind of a departure from everything else, you know, with him trying to, I think, push the bus with his car to get it going. He had thought the truck by then had gone on without him, but then he gets his bumper stuck, and then he sees the truck underneath, you know, coming back on the other end of the tunnel. And then he's trying to save the kids or whatever. But I mean, yeah, that was kind of, I can see now how that would be the extra footage there to kind of lengthen out the movie, because it seemed kind of out of pace with everything else that was going on. But the truck showing up and sitting there just waiting for him to finish, or seeing what he's going to do, they do that in a couple spots. And it's very intimidating, you know, because you know what's been going on with this guy.
All right, so the production of the movie, as it was back then, super short schedule, super cheap. Although I looked, I think it said it was $450,000 budget, which, I mean, is nothing today, but it's still, you know, something. But anyway, yeah, the producer of the movie told Spielberg there's no way he would be able to shoot it all on location. What he needed to do was get Dennis Weaver one day in a shooting stage and do all of the driving stuff, you know, with rear projection or with a process screen, like they do.
Right.
And then you can go out and shoot all of the driving stuff, the exteriors, the road stuff, after you've gotten all the important stuff done. And Spielberg refused. He's just like, I won't. That stuff always looks fake. It never meshes with the real stuff outside. He's like, I think I can do this. And he couldn't convince the producer that to just let him do it, because he was an untested kid. So he said, I will make you a compromise. You know, just let me shoot it the way I want. And if I don't make the 10-day schedule, then, you know, everything that's left we can shoot at the... And the guy, he wouldn't even let him finish. He's like, no, we're going to do it the other way. You go out on Monday and shoot all of the plates for the rear projection so that you have that first. And then you can shoot whatever you want, but, you know, when you run out of time and when you fail at this, you've got all that stuff done and you can just go in the studio and shoot it all in a day, like I said, and have your movie done. And so Spielberg was just like, I'm going to prove this guy wrong. I'm going to show him that I can do this. And one of the things that he did, and it's crazy, but he got 5 camera setups with 5 directors of photography and lined them up along this stretch of highway and started up all of the cameras at the same time and had Dennis Weaver in his car and then the big truck coming down and shot each pass by. So essentially with each take, he got 5 shots done of like the chase and of, you know, the pursuit and of the background and all that stuff. So he got 5 times as much footage as you would with just a normal camera setup. And they, and to make matters even better, they'd keep the camera running. Dennis Weaver would do a U-turn when he got past the last camera and come back the other way. And the truck would do a U-turn and come after Dennis Weaver, coming back the other way. So they got 10 shots. He still couldn't make the 10-day schedule. But the footage that he had gotten was so impressive to the producers that they're like, okay, you can have next Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday to finish up the movie your way. And they never had to use any of those rear projection plates. It was all on location, just there doing what they were trying to do. And Spielberg talks a little bit about just, you know, there was no such thing as a Steadicam in those days. And so to get that footage in the diner, they had to just push around on wheels, you know, a great big loud camera. And then they had to dub all of that stuff over again afterward. And to get just right up alongside these vehicles as they were driving, they had, you know, just the base of a car that had the wheels and, you know, and the engine and the steering wheel, and a cameraman could just stand on that or sit on that, and the driver could just pull it up right alongside or right in front of the big old semi truck. And, you know, probably something super dangerous by today's standards for a cameraman to do. But it's just like that way you can get right in there. Like the truck is just about to run you over, right, you know.
And it's really effective. I mean, you really feel the tension and the reality of what's going on there. And because, like you say, you know, you can see from the truck's perspective going at the car, and you can see from the car's perspective when the truck's coming at it. And there's a couple points where you can tell that it might have been sped up a little bit to make it, you know, really seem like it was going super fast, faster than it probably was, but not too much. I mean, they did a really good job, and there wasn't too many, you know, a lot of times during chase scenes, you can see where, when they have a long shot or something, you can see the truck really coming up on them, like they're really close. But then when you see it from the car's perspective, it's further back than what you just saw.
Sure.
And there's a little bit of that in there that you can see, but not very much for, you know, knowing what the schedule was and what they were doing. There's not a lot of that going on.
Yeah, one of the tricks he said that he used to make it seem like they were going fast was to shoot at an angle where you could always see the background whirring by. You could see the mountains. You could see the telephone poles and all that stuff. Because even if you're going 25 miles an hour, if you focus on the hills or the road or something that is moving, it seems to fly past. And that works with film. I think, yeah, they did speed up a couple of moments. And I don't know how you avoid noticing that. It's just, yeah. There is a feel to sped up footage. But for the most part, yeah, it just... I while I was watching it, I wondered how this movie would be made today, how different it would feel today. And of course, I mean, cell phones.
Right.
You call somebody, you call the cops or whatever, the first time there's any problem with this guy.
Right.
But...
And you get camera footage and all that stuff.
Oh, I hadn't even thought of that. Good point. But there are places that are rural where cell phones don't work. The farming town where I grew up, I was there 3 days ago, and there's still no cell service in 2018. And so...
Yeah, you're out here in Kansas or something.
Yeah. I wondered about that while I was watching the movie. It's just like, okay, how would it be different? How would it be different if it were a woman? David Mann were a woman driving, and... He's an everyman, this character. We relate to him because you've been somebody on a long drive and that. And there's loneliness or whatever. And that and a lot of times in traffic, you start to think of it as a competition. And it's like, okay, you're not getting in front of me. No, there's not enough space. I'll speed up so you won't.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. And then you're furious when somebody does it to you. And that, and I don't know if women are so combative on the freeway in the same way. It would have felt very different. If you shot that today with a lady in Paris. And also though in 1971, as well as 2018, people would be more willing to help out a woman in distress. Like, there's the old couple, and he's like, if you would just take me to the police station. Oh, you don't even have to take me. If you just make a call, and the wife is just like, drive away from this man, kind of thing. I think had David Mann been a woman, they would have helped her out.
What's the matter, car trouble?
Well, in a way, yes. I wonder if you'd do me a favor.
What's that?
Would you stop the nearest telephone you come to and call the police?
Police?
Yeah, you see that truck?
Mr. We don't want any trouble.
No, there won't be any trouble. I'm asking you to do is just call the police.
We better go. Was there
ma'am, all I'm asking you to do is just to make a phone call.
Jim, step on the
phone. My life's in danger. Can't you make a lousy phone call to the lousy police for me?
Stop it, Mr.
Well, just drop me off at the nearest station. I'll pay you for it.
Jim!
I mean, I guess it's just a societal thing. It's still, it's super effective because, yeah, there's no reason for it. This is just a madman that decided to pick him.
And he's determined. I mean, like, when the character, when he'd slow down and there was a time where he was able to hide and sleep for a while. And then he starts going down the road again, just moseying on down. And the truck stopped waiting for him. It's like...
He pulls to a stop, blocking both lanes in the middle of the road. In just like horror of the truck is there.
Yeah. One of the things I kept thinking... I remember I watched it with my wife and I kept saying, why doesn't he just turn around and go home? But I guess the truck could have followed him back that way too. If he would have turned around and gone the other way. But then, I don't know, maybe he was a little bit, I'm not going to let this guy stop me from going where I'm going. I guess he missed his appointment that he was worried about getting, the account that he was going to try to shore up. Then I guess there is the, you know, the one point where it is an actual duel when the truck's just daring him to try to go past him or whatever. And then he gets out in the middle of the road and stops him from going. And Dennis Weaver gets out of his truck. And I guess that part would be the actual duel part where they're kind of playing chicken or whatever. But yeah, you kind of see him change, you know, that he's kind of determined to try to make it. Was there any other part that you wanted to talk about?
Oh, I think we've talked about the most memorable stuff. There's the point where he finally decides to call the police. He pulls up to this, I don't even know if it's a gas station. It's like a roadside, what would you call that? A place where you can see like tarantulas and rattlesnakes and...
Yeah, like just a side road attraction, I guess.
Mind checking those radiator hoses?
I'll do that. Take a look at my snakes if you have time.
And he just wants to use the phone and, you know, he gets on there and the truck driver just mows down the phone booth. And it's at this point, it's just like he doesn't care that there's a witness.
Right.
He turns around and he starts crashing into these cages where the animals are or whatever, trying to kill man.
And he keeps going. He doesn't just try once. He just keeps on going around trying to get him.
Up to that point, I think he had shown a little restraint, this killer. He had played it a little more safe. You know, it's like he didn't get to this point in his life by taking chances. But maybe David Mann lasted longer than some of these other people do. Or maybe the truck driver's just having a bad day because he's like, no, you're not. That is against the rules, calling the police. And yeah, I gotta splat you now. I don't know. Again, the fact that we don't know why he's doing this or what's going through his mind and all that just makes it, he's an alien. I don't know why he's doing this. And that's cool.
Yeah, it really works. It's effective. And I guess, you know, that's another thing that I'm really glad you watched that documentary, because there was a lot of good stuff on there. And I'm glad you shared that with us, with me, I guess, and the audience. But one of the other things I thought was really cool was when he talked about at the end. Well, I don't know if we want to give away the end, but
no, it's fine. I mean, if people haven't seen Duel, I cannot recommend it enough. It is a great film, and when you think about how little it cost, and you're a child of the 70s, how low the bar was set in the 70s for television.
Oh yeah.
That
for TV movies.
That something this solid came out of that. Yeah, so it's even more impressive. But yeah, okay. So if you haven't gone out and seen it, please do, and then we can talk about the ending. We'll still be here.
We will. But yeah, so at the end when the truck is going over the cliff and crashing down. I mean, that was all real, right? And you can tell that they really destroyed that truck. But Steven Spielberg talked about adding like a roar to it. Like, I can't remember where they got the sound effect, but it was like a...
I think it was an old dinosaur sound effect from like a stop motion King Kong era kind of thing.
Okay, yeah. And if you listen really carefully, you can hear, you know, when the truck's crashing down and all this stuff's going on, you can hear that roar, but just barely in the thing. And I thought that was really cool. And he also mentioned that he added that same sound effect, or that's it. I don't know if it was the exact same sound effect, but he added a similar type roar when Jaws was killed at the end and when he was floating down to the bottom of the ocean. And I thought that was really cool.
It is the exact same sound effect, but because it's underwater, it's a little bit more echoey and, I don't know, maybe less recognizable as a dinosaur. But I noticed in Jaws the Revenge, the fourth one, that they use that sound when the dinosaur comes out of the water. It goes, or whatever. And I was just like, oh, gosh, dude. Now, of course, you know, that was 1986 or something like that. They'd never do that today. Except I saw the trailer for Meg before Jurassic World. Oh, right. And the dinosaur roars in that. Sorry. I called it a dinosaur. Freudian slip. The shark roars in that.
I was pretty fascinated when he was talking about that. And it just made me think of how big of an influence Duel was on Jaws as a whole. You know, like you said, there's the similar elements of, you know, we don't see the shark. And I know that a lot of that was production issues and it became a benefit to the film in the end. But you see that same pattern that he had in Duel, you know, building up the antagonist that you don't see and kind of the escalation of what's going on with the shark in Jaws. And I don't know, I was interested to hear your thoughts on kind of the influence of this movie on Jaws and maybe other movies that have come around, like Maximum Overdrive or anything like that.
Well, okay, the movie that Spielberg did after Duel was called Sugarland Express, and you can see a little bit of the influence of Duel in that, too. It's mostly a car chase movie, you know, a pursuit kind of movie, but, you know, it's the police instead of a truck-driving serial killer. But, yeah, there are stylistic choices that Spielberg did, things probably that he learned while making Duel that he's like, oh, I wish I could have done it this way. Oh, hey, I've got the opportunity to do it that way on this. And, you know, my favorite Spielberg movie and my favorite scene in my favorite Spielberg movie is Raiders of the Lost Ark, truck chase sequence in Raiders.
Oh, sure.
And there are a couple of moments with that were just, you know, lessons that he learned making this movie of, you know, how to make it look more dangerous than it is and how to make it look faster than it is. And
it's got some of those same shots. Yeah, you're right.
I don't know. Jurassic Park does a little bit, not as much as Jaws, with let's not show the bad guy. Let's not show the creature. Let's not show the monster. Let's not show the extraterrestrial in E.T., for a good chunk.
Right.
And in Jaws, it was accidental. They couldn't get the shark to work. And so Spielberg would do what he could with the fin or with nothing at all. And it worked so well that the audience all assumed that was intentional. Wow. Okay. Well, this guy's a genius. John Williams is the shark in this scene. Have you ever noticed, you know, that kind of thing. And so I think he's done that several times over his career, where it's like, okay, do we have to show the Velociraptor kill this guy in the opening of Jurassic Park? What if we just hint that it got him? We see the people's reactions, we hear shouting, we hear the noise, but we don't see it. And it's weird, even in Lost World, where it's the sequel to Jurassic Park, we already know what the dinosaurs look like. He still stretches out the reveal of the T-Rex. He's like, okay, you know what the T-Rex looks like, but I'm not going to show it to you anyway. For no reason, except for just because we expect it. We expect to see it, and we're not seeing it. And maybe that makes us uneasy. Maybe we're frustrated. Why are we not seeing it? What is happening? Kind of thing. And that's, I don't know. That's something that he learned, something that is a Hitchcockian device. And Duel is a movie filled with Hitchcockian devices.
Oh, yeah, for sure. That's probably another reason why I like it so much. Well, there was one of the other...
Oh, just one more thing. There was a movie, and I don't know when it is. Give me 3 seconds. There was a 2001 movie called Joyride that I really, really liked. But I don't ever run into people that liked Joyride, that talk about Joyride. But it's basically Three college students are on a road trip and they piss off a dude in a car. And he decides, maybe he's on the same route as they are. Maybe not. Maybe he deviates from his route to go after them. And we never know why or what, you know, he's just, they've angered him and now he wants to kill them. And oh my gosh, through that movie, I kept thinking about Duel and there would be parallels. And I'd think, is this an accident? Or did the filmmakers love Duel? And it's a movie that's very, very similar. It has a similar feel. And again, you never see the guy in this car that's after them. You know, you see his arm and you see his silhouette and all that. And that has to be absolutely intentional based on Duel. In fact, I'm looking on the Wikipedia page and there are several references to Duel in the movie where they copied shots and copied set dressing and all that stuff because the director, John Dahl, was a huge fan of Duel. Oh, J.J. Abrams wrote Joyride. Weird.
Oh, there you go.
Huh.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, sorry about that. That's a deviation, but nobody ever talks about that movie. I really liked it. It had Paul Walker and Steve Zahn in it. I don't know. I recommend it. Although I haven't seen it in years, I just remember coming out of that and thinking, wow, that was really, really solid. And a lot of times horror movies don't even have to be solid. They can be crap and they will still make money because the audience is so hungry for it.
Well, and, you know, referencing a movie like Duel, I mean, you know, most people wouldn't even know what Duel was or hadn't seen it. You know, it's this old TV movie. I mean, of course, filmmakers would know about it, but the general audience wouldn't. So why not reference it? And the other movie I thought of was Maximum Overdrive, just because it has the big semi in it with the goblin face on it.
And that's a literal living truck. I mean, there is no driver in that one. And what did Duel influence King in writing that?
And who knows? Yeah, I don't know.
Well, I remember he wrote something. Stephen King wrote a short story called Road Rage or something like that. That was, oh, I take it back. It was called Throttle. He wrote a short story that was just an homage to Duel. Two vehicles going down the road and one of them decides, well, I'm going to take out this other one. And, you know, like who will survive kind of thing. So yes, I would think it's fair to say that King was very influenced by this.
You know, I want to say, I remember back in the day reading a Orson Scott Card short story where there was no truck or anything, but it was this guy that was on a long drive and he started kind of playing the game, you know, following, leapfrogging with this other car. And it kind of escalated into where that car ended up going off a cliff or something like that. And he kind of got off on that and kind of got addicted to killing people or whatever.
Right, right. And he messes with the wrong woman. There's a woman in like a little sedan or whatever, and he tries to run her off the road. And she's a match for him. And I think he ends up meeting his death in the exact same way that he intended for her to die.
Okay, that sounds familiar, yeah. I didn't think about that till just right now, but I'll have to find the name of that and put it in the show notes or something. I don't know if if you caught my text on this, but there's one other show that this influenced.
Go ahead and talk about it. I tried to watch it during the we were going to record about an hour ago or before we did. And during that time, I tried to find it so I could watch it and we could talk about it. Because I guess Spielberg got a bee in his bonnet about it. And he's like, go ahead and talk about.
Okay. So we all remember the television show, The Incredible Hulk. Dr. David Banner, physician, scientist, surgeon. I think it was 76. Through 78 or 77.
Yeah.
and with Bill Bixby and Lou Ferrigno. And anyway, I was a couple years ago, I started going through, I found it on Hulu or Netflix or something. Now it's on Hulu. I think I might have been on Netflix at the time. I started going through the episodes because I couldn't remember everything that happened. And I ran across, it was in season one, and it was episode 10, and it's titled Never Give a Trucker an Even Break. And they use, like, I'd say almost half the episode. Well, maybe not half, because, you know, he has to transfer into the old twice in the movie. But anyway, they take a lot of footage directly from Duel. And it's the, you know, he's hitchhiking on the, at the beginning of the episode, and a lady picks him up in a car and takes him into town, and she asks him to surprise her boyfriend or whatever with a card or something. And so he goes and delivers the card and gets all the people, everybody that works for this guy in this kind of like trucking yard or whatever, to come around. And then she steals this truck, and it's the same, the big, oily, dirty, rusty tanker truck. And she steals it because I guess it belongs to her, and they stole it. And they had filled it full, the tanker full of all these contraband computer parts or something stupid like that. And so there's the scene where her and Bill Bixby, because he jumps onto the truck, you know, she's like, come on. And they get in the truck. And then the other guys come out, and they're going to go chase after her in the truck. Well, there's the red car that's from Duel, and the same make and everything. And they get in there, and they're taking off after the truck. And it's funny because, you know, when you watch the movie, and it's only Dennis Weaver in the car. There's a driver and no passengers in the car. But so there's these two guys chasing after the truck, and all the scenes that are from Duel, they go out of their way to find ways for the guy's trying to find a gun, so he has to get in the glove compartment. And so he's ducked down, so when they show the exterior shot, that you only see the driver in there. And then he has to go get the bullets from the back seat and all this kind of stuff. And it's just funny to watch how they go around this footage so they can use it for a lot of their shots. And then a bunch of stuff happens, and then eventually it's turned around where the two guys that are after the girl are in the truck, and her and Bill Bixby are in the car. And the whole scene with them going up the hill, and the radiator goes out, and the truck's catching up to them coming up the hill, and all that stuff. And the crash and all that, it's all taken directly from Duel. But they work it into this episode and change into the Hulk twice and all that kind of stuff. And I just couldn't believe it, what I was watching when I was watching that episode. And I got my wife in there to watch it. And I'm like, look at this. This is all stolen directly from Duel. I got a kick out of that. It's pretty. So if you do get a chance to watch it, I definitely would, because it's pretty funny.
Okay, well, yeah, I should check it out on Hulu. I looked on Netflix, and then I went on YouTube. And on YouTube, someone had uploaded the first transformation scene where David Banner is in a payphone.
Right.
And it almost seems like a parody of The Incredible Hulk. The payphone eats his dime, and he's just like, oh, no, operator. And he calls, and I don't know if he called the operator or who he called, but this woman is the most unhelpful woman. And he's like, there is a woman in danger, and I need the police. And she's like, I'm not the police, sir. And he's like, I know that, but I need to call the police. I can't transfer you, sir. And he's like, this is important. And she's like, well, you need to hang up and call the police. And he says, I don't have any more dimes. And his eyes are starting to go the contacts or whatever. It's like, okay.
Please deposit 25 cents for the first 3 minutes.
I don't have 25 cents.
Then I can't complete the call, sir. Sir? Sir, hello. Are you there? Sir, hello. Are you there?
a very pedestrian reason
right.
to turn into the Hulk. Because usually it was like, okay, some guys in a bar decide to beat him up with pool cues or, you know, oh no, bees. Or he's like, oh, he got shocked. The electricity got him. And oh, and that turns him into the Hulk. But this, it was just a bad phone experience. He turns into the Hulk. And he smashes the phone receiver with his fist and just wrecks the payphone. And I wondered, this is being played for laughs, right? I don't know. They had to know, right, at this point. I'm surprised that it was the 10th episode of the first season.
Yeah, me too.
When you're doing something like that.
There's another, there's a lot of funny ones, but there's another one when he's in New York and he's stuck in traffic. And he just gets all upset because he's trying to save somebody or whatever, and they're getting away. And so he hulks out in the back of a cab. And then he's running through Times Square as the Hulk. And that one was pretty good, too.
But this is years and years later, or this is...
No, this isn't...
Still early on in the show. Yeah,
still early on in the show. So, and then, you know, I remember there was an earthquake episode of the Hulk, and there was probably some TV movie that had been done years ago about an earthquake that they stole footage from that one too, because there were buildings breaking up and all that kind of stuff.
Well, it might have been the Chuck Heston movie Earthquake.
Oh, it could have been.
Because that was a universal property.
Oh, right.
And maybe they're just like, okay, we've got all these buildings shaking and things falling apart, and it's like, yeah, let's do it.
But you said Spielberg was upset that they did that. I would be too. I mean, it was direct poaching, so.
Yeah, well, I honestly hadn't heard about Never Give a Trucker an Even Break until you sent me that text. And so I was looking for it today, and yeah, there was just a little bit on one of the uploads where somebody had taken a scene from it saying, you know, this is one of the numerous scenes that Spielberg was so upset with, where, it's just footage from Duel, and then an insert of David Banner, you know, in a similar
right.
vehicle.
Looking at the speedometer, just like the movie.
It is interesting that the film hasn't been remade. Except for Poltergeist, which has an asterisk on it, no Spielberg movie has been remade. And so I don't know if the moment Steven Spielberg dies, every studio that has the rights to any of his stuff will just start him up.
Yeah, but it'll be like the new Stephen King revival. It'll be a Spielberg pillage his old work kind of thing.
But I think that this story could work today just as well as it worked then, with almost no changes at all.
Yeah. Yeah, they'd have to get creative with it, you know, with, like you said, cell phones and just, it's a different world now than it was back then. But like you said, you could do it, though, in a rural area where things maybe are more like they were in the 70s. And
yeah, I wonder how important the setting is. Because I was going to say, well, you set it in Montana or something where there's no city for 60 miles in any direction. And suddenly it's just like, okay, it's believable that there would be no cell phone service for an hour. And you're just like, oh, okay, well, this would be a bad place to have a problem. But I imagine Nevada is very similar
to sure.
that. And you do have the desert.
Right, some better backdrops and stuff.
And I would much rather break down in Montana than in the middle of Nevada.
For sure. Yeah, I've done my fair share of travel through there. I was working at a gold mine site that was near Tonopah, or, you know, near in Nevada is a relative term, but Tonopah is pretty much the middle of nowhere. And there's nothing around it. So, yeah, that'd be a good setting for a new Duel movie. Maybe we should make it.
Oh, I don't know.
Or we can produce it.
You can't really improve on this.
No.
There are a couple moments here or there that are a little bit dated. but just a little bit in that, okay, you know, things don't quite look like that anymore. But you could just make this script and maybe some, you'd have to throw in two or three lines about cell phones and stuff. But I think it would probably work just as well.
And like you said, they could switch it up and have a woman driver. So that would be interesting. But we should probably wrap this up. It's kind of been a fun experiment. I've enjoyed talking about Duel with you. I could think of us having fun talking about other movies.
Yeah, I think it would be fun if it wasn't always a good movie either. Because sometimes you can learn a lot by saying, why didn't this work? And, that scene should have been scary or that scene should have been funny, and it wasn't. What did they do wrong? And stuff like that. I love to have conversations like that. So maybe we keep that in mind for future movies. It's like, it doesn't have to be a classic. It can be a movie where it's just like, there's no reason this shouldn't have been a great movie.
Right. Yeah, as long as we don't, you know, I don't want to stifle any That Gets My Goat episodes or anything. Or become a competition for the Dune Steve.
Well, those are pretty few and far between, really.
Yeah.
I think there is room for both. And I imagine that the kinds of movies that you would want to review on here would be different than the tentpole blockbusters that Big and I talk about.
Yeah, yeah. It wouldn't be the current. It'd probably be, it wouldn't have to be back in 71, but... you know, some older movies that aren't what everybody else is talking about kind of thing.
Yeah, there's a 1959 movie called The Wasp Woman.
Ooh.
That I think would make a really good episode.
The Wasp Woman. Was she a superhero? Was she the first superhero?
No, it's a Roger Corman, really cheap black and white, you know, horror kind of thing.
Sure. The Wasp Woman. Well, I guess... we'll have to see if I don't know. Let's see what the audience response is on this one. See if we get any requests for more episodes like this. And like I say, maybe I'll put up a Patreon and I can start trying to fund more for this podcast. But I guess if
that would be great.
If we continue to do more, though, I guess we'd have to come up with a name for it or something.
Oh. Okay, do you have anything in mind?
Well, we could try to merge something between the Journey Into and the Dune Steve podcasts, or I don't know. I was trying to think of something to keep in line with the Journey Into, the Journey, the Path, you know, that kind of the theme for the. So the only thing I could kind of come up with was like vistas. You know, if you're on a journey, you come up to these vistas and you look out over the country or whatever. So we could call it cinematic vistas or something like that. But that could be a little too hokey too.
Well, that sounds like a serious show. Is this going to be a serious show?
No, not really. I mean, as serious as this one was, but we're not critics or anything like that. We're just talking about shows.
Okay, well, if somebody has a good idea, that's cool. I always felt like Strewn Along the Path, like it was meant to evoke Journey Into in a way, like if you had several podcasts, they'd all be, you know, Meandering at Night,
right,
you know,
stuff something like that.
They're
like
all
that.
About
right.
Traveling.
Yeah, exactly. Something and, like that. Well, we could call it Journey Outfield or something like that.
Well, I appreciate that. That's really cool. But I, you know, Journey Afield sounds so much better than Outfield. But but yeah, something like that where we could combine our two enormous fan bases.
Yes, yes.
We become a super group like, what was the name of that band? That I Never Meant to Be So Bad to You.
Oh.
Heat of the Mama. Asia was a super group.
Chickenfoot. Well, we'll have to work on that name. But
yeah, let's do this again sometime and we will talk about a movie that's bad. We could even talk about a movie that's notoriously bad, where it's like, you know, I never saw that because I heard it was just one of the worst. And they're like, oh, well, but I'd see it if we could make an episode about it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's worth it for the conversation, I'd say. So, okay. Well, we'll try to do this again sometime in the future.
Okay.
But I guess since I started this out as a Strewn Along the Path episode, I guess, you know, we'll have to come back around here sometime again and see what else is strewn along the path. See you later.
Yes. Drive safe.
Journey on. I don't know what I think I'm doing. Nobody's going to pay for this podcast. Even if I do a Patreon. I don't know why I podcast. I don't think anybody listens. I just keep talking and talking and talking, and I don't think anybody's hearing me. But they tell you, if you just keep doing a podcast, people will listen. And then I put it out there, and what's going to happen? Somebody's going to steal it. Somebody's going to play this audio. They're going to change it up. They're going to make it sound different. They'll probably sell it, too, and make money off my podcast. I don't make any money. Why should they make any money? I don't know what to do. Calm down. Calm down. That's why I have Creative Commons. I can make it attribution and non-commercial. No derivatives license. That way people can't sell it, people can't get money from it, people can't change it, and people have to give me credit for the audio. Yeah, Creative Commons, that's good. People are going to listen, I know they will, and they'll even leave a voicemail or email, and it'll be all right. I just have to keep going. Now if I could just figure out the whole Patreon thing, I can do it, I can podcast.
I don't think you can be a filmmaker, a serious filmmaker, making audience popcorn movies unless you believe the stories you're telling. I haven't seen Duel in a long time, but I mean, my memory of Duel as a film is that I was really proud of it. I look back at it, number one, saying, how did I get all those shots in 12 or 13 days? How was that possible? To this day, I don't think I could do it again. If I had to go back right now and recreate Duel in 12, 13 days, I couldn't do it. It'd be impossible. I think I was so hungry. Back then, I was so ambitious. I was so excited about having been given this chance to have done it that way again, which means a lot of the spontaneity would be left out. I would be the Europeans analyzing Duel and putting all those different levels of interpretation into it now. I think I'd be too headstrong about telling that story again. So sometimes you have to look back and say, you know, those early films are a mark and a measure of who I was back then. I could never go back and make those early films as well as I made them when I was of the appropriate age and naivete to be working on subjects like that. But also, I couldn't have made Schindler's List or Private Ryan when I was 22, 23 years old either. So it's a fair trade-off.
All right. Hey there. Welcome to another, welcome to the Journey Into podcast. We're here.
Wait, what are we doing?
We're doing a Strewn Along the Path episode.
Okay.
And, yeah, let me start all over.